This week on Behind the Lens. State and local school leaders scramble to prepare for a new school year, but COVID-19 could throw plenty of wrenches in the works. Governor Edwards hosts a who's who of White House officials and Republican leaders, including Vice President Pence, Education Secretary DeVos, and U.S. Senator Bill Cassidy.
I will speak as a physician who happens to be a doctor.
We'll hear more about the federal push to reopen schools come hell or high water. Columnist Stephanie Grace offers her reaction to this week's meetings. And a top researcher at Tulane talks about a new study of how schools have responded so far to the pandemic. I'm Tom Wright. You're listening to Behind the Lens, brought to you by Community Support. Learn more at thelensnola.org/donate. We welcome listeners on our partner radio stations, 90.3 FM WAMF LP and 102.3 FM WHIV LP New Orleans. Louisiana's Board of Elementary and Secondary Education has approved a minimum set of safety standards for schools to allow them to reopen this fall. Those standards include limits on classroom and school bus capacity. They came out Tuesday, and now local school districts are finalizing their own reopening policies according to these messy standards, the Lens Marta Jusen reports.
A new law that was passed last week actually kind of kicked this process off and required that the board set minimum standards for schools to open. They did pass those standards this week, and basically what we're seeing in those standards are things like, in phase two, which we're in now, classrooms can only have 25 people in them. Then that includes the teacher. Also has to account for any special ed teachers that need to come in. And, you know, the social distancing that we've been practicing is not specifically laid out in there at 6 feet, though it is encouraged. And then the other big one for school systems is going to be in phase two, buses have to run at 50% capacity. There are a lot of administrators who are worried about that restriction, you know, people in rural districts and urban districts alike.
You have to wonder if they're cutting in half the capacity per bus, whether that's going to be they'll need more buses running, or that they expect fewer students, or if they're going to have to stagger class times due to bus arrivals. Just some examples of the logistical headaches that you're probably looking at as school administrators.
Right, and that is not a fun problem for them to be solving. Don't envy that in any way.
Right. And then there is the risk that a lot of these buildings may not actually be able to reopen here in New Orleans during phase two.
Yeah. Earlier this week, the superintendent and Dr. Avegno from the city health department held a press conference, and they kind of set the tone that, you know, it is possible that even though we thought schools would be open in phase two, they might not be reopening buildings, especially, you know, we've seen cases continue to rise in the city and across the state.
We're going to talk a little bit more about the debate over reopening the schools here in the podcast in a few minutes. But first, before we let you go, I understand there's an update on the concerns about immersion teachers and whether some of them would be allowed to come in country for the school year. What's the latest?
Yeah, so some of our state's immersion schools have been grappling with this problem for about a month, both because the French government was worried that its teachers wouldn't be able to come into the country and they wanted them to have jobs. And then the president's visa ban all but ensured those people wouldn't be able to come over. But this week, schools did get some good news that about 70 teachers who had planned to come over are going to be able to qualify for an exception to the president's ban on certain types of visas. That is a process, I believe, that still has to get worked out. So I don't think we know if those teachers are going to make it for the beginning of school, but they at least will be able to join at some point this school year.
Marta, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bessie's meeting on Tuesday took place just 3 miles from Tiger Stadium in Baton Rouge, where Vice President Mike Pence and other leaders from Washington sat on a panel urging schools to reopen. Among the VP's entourage, Dr. Deborah Birx. She is the White House's coronavirus response coordinator, and she talked specifically about the worsening caseloads across our state.
The epidemic you're facing today in Louisiana is different than the epidemic that you had in March and April. That was very much centered in New Orleans and a little bit in Baton Rouge. This particular epidemic, although the cases are still low, is spread across the state of Louisiana. And that's why the governor is correct. It will take everyone in Louisiana, every single person in Louisiana, to wear a mask. It will take all of those residents to social distance to practice personal hygiene. And as Coach O explained to me, he was able to keep his football players safe and healthy and well here and tested until some might have wandered off to a bar. And after wandering off to a bar, they did become positive. And so he's made it clear that that is not on any longer the itinerary for a practice. And so we are really calling on all Louisianas to not be going to bars, not to be even going to bars in people's houses. Social gathering of more than 10 people right now is particularly difficult with the type of spread that you have. But it is this public health group and this governor who was able to stop a very serious epidemic in New Orleans. And it's why these cases are still low, that we have the opportunity to change the future for Louisiana and be able to decrease the number of cases every day if each of us wear our masks, stay out of bars, make sure you don't have large gatherings in your households, and really protect one another and do what we always have said, protecting the most vulnerable in all age groups that may have comorbidities because of their higher risk of severe disease.
The vice president visited Governor Edwards with cabinet officials and top congressional Republicans from Louisiana, part of that broad campaign to fully open American classrooms for in-person learning. Pence and Edwards took reporter questions Tuesday on Louisiana's reopening plans.
We are going to follow CDC guidelines. We heard from Dr. Redfield yesterday, who heads up the CDC, on a video telephone conference, and he talked about situations that are particularly applicable here in Louisiana where you have a high degree of community spread of coronavirus and you're going to open schools. He said one of the things you really have to do is focus on mask usage, especially in those areas where you cannot get the physical distancing that you might otherwise want. The universal, and I think he used the word universal, mask usage is going to be critically important for the safety of the children, but also of the adults, the faculty and the staff as well. We heard from higher education today, it's going to be a combination of virtual and in-person instruction, and they may be platooning. So that if you have a Tuesday, Thursday class, you may be in class on Tuesday and it may be virtual on Thursday and so forth. But we can do this. It's not going to be easy. And quite frankly, it won't be without controversy. But this is what the situation demands. And we're going to reopen our schools, Lord willing, on time. And we're going to do that in just about a month from now.
Dr. Redfield and the team at CDC will issue additional guidance for parents for the operation of facilities. But to be very clear, we don't want CDC guidance to be a reason why people don't reopen their schools. We're going to respect whatever decisions are made on campuses like this across the state of Louisiana. All of us are going to put the health of our kids, of our faculty, and families first. But as the governor said, we believe we can do this. We know that the risk the coronavirus presents to people under the age of 18 is very low. But we also want to make sure that we have measures in place that protect faculty that may be vulnerable and also prevent kids from exposing others or bringing home the virus. So that guidance will continue to be developed and produced, and we'll be working very closely with states and school systems around the country to implement plans. But President Trump has said it, we'll say it again today, we got to get our kids back in the classroom.
This remarkable visit was a topic this week for columnist and editorial writer Stephanie Grace. She writes with our partners at the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate. I asked her specifically about the vice president's comments on CDC guidelines.
For the Vice President of the United States to basically say CDC guidance should be looked at a little bit skeptically, which is certainly the way that comment came across, is shocking. It's not what normally happens. The CDC, of course, is part of the government, part of the federal government. It is the kind of longstanding agency that is looked upon as apolitical. This is, of course, a very political situation. Donald Trump has made it clear that he wants kids in school, and just like he wants businesses open and he wants the stock market going and he wants the economy back in time for his election. That's all connected. The CDC guidance, they came out with an internal document that was circulated and released and published in the New York Times, or at least described in the New York Times, that had a lot of questions, that raised a lot of concerns over the safety. It did not say we shouldn't have school, but it did say in order to have school safely, here are some of the considerations.
What were some of the particular points that stood out to you in that list?
Distancing, masks, you know, the ones we all know.
Right.
Testing, contact tracing, things that cost money, and also a plan on what to do if somebody's infected, which of course is pretty likely, you know, a student, a teacher, a what if. So there are all kinds of really difficult questions here. And what the administration is doing, it seems to me, is going around really kind of pressuring localities to get classes open without offering a lot of support, the type of support they need, such as guidance that, you know, they would get behind, and frankly, money. So it's interesting that at the same time, at the very same time, Pence was at LSU with John Bel Edwards and all the other dignitaries. BESSE, the Board of Elementary Secondary Education, was having a meeting trying to come up with some guidance for school districts. And it was a contentious meeting. It was 4 hours, and they did come up with guidance, you know, limiting how many people can be in one place at one time,
right.
You know, whether there's a lot of debate on how strongly to impose, you know, how to word the mask suggestion / mandate, which of course is a very politicized issue. What to do about kids on buses. Of course, this is a huge issue in places like New Orleans, where you have everyone's bused because everybody goes to a school that's, you know, not in their neighborhood. You know, there's been pushback. And one of the things you're seeing nationally, I think, and here too, is that some of the resistance to this push to kind of close your eyes and plow ahead and hope everything's going to be okay is coming from teacher unions. And of course, in other places, the teacher unions are much stronger. And some cities in California, for example, they have basically already decided that there will not be in-person class in the fall. That's not the decision here. That's not what John Bel Edwards says he wants. That's not what anyone is really planning. Although I guess Jefferson Parish has now pushed back for a week. You know, everything
right.
is still so fluid and it's coming up so quickly. So to plan is just really asking a lot.
On the other hand, to hear it from some of the dignitaries you just mentioned, and I will play a little sound from both Betsy DeVos, the education secretary under President Trump, and our own U.S. Senator John Kennedy on not just the desirability to reopen schools, but the track record so far in terms of other countries reopening schools. We'll listen to that.
Germany, France, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, Austria, South Korea, Japan, even Vietnam, for God's sakes, have opened their schools, and they've done so safely. And so can America, and so should America.
As has been noted, the question of a child's health is a multidimensional one. And we know that too many kids today have been harmed by being at home these last several months, their mental well-being, their socio-emotional growth, and particularly those that are most vulnerable among us have been harmed by not being able to continue their learning and continue to be in classrooms with their teachers and their peers. So I know that Americans are a people of great determination and action and can-do spirit. And this is a great opportunity for adults to step up and show and demonstrate and model grit and determination to ensure that kids can continue their learning come fall.
So when the administration says we want kids in school, I mean, come on, everybody wants kids in school. Let's be honest here. John Kennedy suggested otherwise this week on Sean Hannity in saying that some people were resisting for political purposes. I have never met a person who would do that to children. If he has names, I would like him to name names. But this is to act as if this is not a good faith expression of concern, I think, is what's concerning to people.
Given where we are headed as a country into presidential elections, which Lord knows we don't have time to fully flesh that topic out, but what will our experience as a state tell voters about the broader experience as a country in the elections that are coming up later this year, given that we have so many question marks as well? I just want to, you know, get your thoughts of where we are politically and where Louisiana is in that picture.
Well, obviously, Louisiana is not a swing state. The expectation is that Donald Trump will win the electoral votes here, and we don't have a heavily contested Senate race at this point. You know, it's not one of those states that's going to get a lot of attention. So I think the audience is the rest of the country, the intended audience for the most part. And a couple things. One is that, you know, it is a place where the federal response has been better than in other places. So I think having a Democrat stand up and say that is helpful to the administration.
Arizona comes to mind as a case in point there.
I think having Coach O in the photo op was something they wanted very much, saying we all need to get back to school because we need football. Now, he is, from all I hear, a wonderful man. He is not a public health expert. And of course, everybody wants football. I mean, some people don't like football, but, you know, I don't think there's an agenda in not having football here. And one thing that I think is kind of an interesting, I don't know if this helps the administration, but I mean, this is a state that did have an early peak and then got it under control and then lost control. So it's a cautionary tale, certainly. Like, once you get the numbers down, you can't just open up willy-nilly. And I don't think John Bel Edwards has done that. He's getting a lot of pushback from Republicans in the state, including, ironically, Attorney General Jeff Landry, who just was diagnosed with coronavirus the other day. It was interesting to hear the rhetoric because Vice President Pence said, congratulated the state on how it had gotten the numbers under control and said, you're going to do it again. I certainly hope we're going to do it again. I don't know.
We don't have much choice in the matter. You know, last question. How are you and your family? Hope you're all well.
All well. All fine. Thank you very much. How about you?
Well, very well. Thank you so much, Stephanie Grace, with our partners at the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate, NOLA.com. Yes. Thank you, Stephanie.
Thanks.
School officials and the communities they serve have been coping with the COVID-19 crisis for more than 4 months now. A new survey examines how those many different types of schools have responded so far in Louisiana and nationwide. Douglas Harris at Tulane University directs the National Center for Education Access and Choice. He says the pandemic's impact on education draws an immediate comparison to Hurricane Katrina, though on a much wider scale.
Students, you know, in Katrina left the city and went to regular in-person schools and other places, but it was still a disruption in their school environments. They were still thrown in situations where they had lost their social relationships. They lost them in a different way. They had the opportunity to create new ones, but you're very suddenly disrupted from your friendships in that situation in a way that's not totally unlike working remotely.
And that certainly plays into some of the present day debate in terms of schools reopening. But I thought we'd just work from the bullet points of your findings. The one that certainly stands out for a Metro New Orleans audience is charter schools, in terms of tending to, as you say here, outperform traditional public schools in terms of maintaining high academic expectations. On the other hand, your traditional model public schools seem to be doing more for students with disabilities, which I know are a big focus for your group, as well as English language learners.
Yeah, I think the patterns actually line up with what we know about the strengths and weaknesses of these different groups of schools before this happened. So, you know, there's evidence, you know, not just New Orleans, but beyond, the charter schools sure. being better over time academically, that they tended to have high academic expectations of students. Similarly, there's evidence that traditional public schools tend to be more open to serving all students and tend to have this mission and ethos of serving the whole child and serving every child through special education programs and other programs that are meant to serve their needs. So it actually lined up, I would say, in a lot of ways with what we would have expected. I don't think we went into it with really strong expectations, but when we saw the patterns, I think our reaction was, okay, well, that makes sense based on what we knew before.
Does this underscore a notion that the higher achieving student levels are more advantageous for your charter school management?
They're in some sense easier and less costly to serve. The one-on-one attention that often comes with special education services,
right,
is just that's more expensive than the general education classroom is. And then when you look at it from an accountability standpoint, the charter schools, you know, they're going to keep their contracts. They need to keep their scores up, and the students with disabilities and others will tend to have lower scores. And so that becomes both more costly and creates pressure and standards on the school that are going to be difficult to reach.
Your report found there was not a statistically significant difference in terms of performance.
When we looked at it by sector, we saw that traditional public schools outperform both charter schools and private schools on the breadth of services and equity of access, but then charter schools outperformed on other kinds of personalization and engagement and progress monitoring, and that private schools were similar on those other dimensions, but they didn't exceed either traditional public schools or charter schools on either dimension.
So is it fair to say that whether you're private charter or a traditional public model school, you've got a lot of work to do, to say the least, in responding to a pandemic as we're facing today?
Well, I think it's just reflecting that it is certainly hard to respond to a pandemic. And I think, you know, to me, another way of looking at the punchline here is that the type of school that you're in, you know, whether it's traditional public, charter, or private, was not the main determining factor in what schools did.
The strongest predictor that your report found was what?
Was parent education level. So, whether parents, or what percentage of parents and others in the neighborhood have a college degree is the strongest predictor. It's not that surprising also in retrospect, that when we look at other research just predicting student outcomes, the strongest predictor in those cases is also parent education level, more so than income or race or type of school attended or anything like that. And then if you think about it in the pandemic, with everything being moved into the home environment, you can imagine that parents matter even more. Because you've got parents with college degrees, mostly with white collar jobs, who can work at home, who can still help their children learn, you know, walk down the hall in between Zoom calls and see how they're doing on their homework. If you think about the grocery store cashier, or people who pick up the trash, or people who work in restaurants that may have reopened, that those kinds of jobs don't lend themselves to working at home, and therefore less opportunity to help students. So that all the things that normally make parent education levels important for children just compounded in the situation.
And you reference Zoom calls and Wi-Fi access, and that's on its own. That's another critically important indicator in this study, isn't it?
That's right. So yeah, whether there was broadband access or high-speed internet access was also a strong predictor of school responses. You know, the other thing that's important to bear in mind here is the difference between what the schools did and what the students experienced. So, you know, I think part of what we saw, and this was also looking not just at the website data, but at other survey evidence from other studies that have come out. You know, most of those surveys were focusing on student engagement with schools, but student engagement with schools isn't just about what the schools did, right? It's about, you know, is there internet access at home? Are the parents there to help guide students through the learning experience? Are the students of an age where they can manage themselves and focus on schooling activities? So all these other things going on that make this difference between what the schools did and what the students experienced. We were really focused in our analysis on what the schools did. Mm-hmm. And now if you look at and they're making their decisions based on what they think the parents want and what the parents' situations handle. So if you're in a rural area, if you're a school in a rural area, you're thinking, all right, well, it's March and we just went to remote instruction. What are we going to do?
Right.
We're probably not going to do live Zoom calls because in rural areas, broadband access isn't very high. Or even in some urban neighborhoods, broadband access might not be very high because of income-based reasons.
Right. Very important point when we're talking about virtual learning options. Speaking of geographic factors, how do Southern schools compare with other regions, Northeast, Midwest, in terms of the COVID response?
Yeah, that was one thing that, if there was any surprise, that was one surprise. So southern states, the schools didn't respond as comprehensively as they did in especially the Midwest and to some degree the Northeast as well. The main theory we have, and it really is just kind of a guesstimate at this case, is that in the South, we have the school year ending earlier. So we're ending even on a regular schedule in mid-May. And that schools may have not responded as comprehensively because the students wouldn't have as much time to benefit from whatever they were going to do. For the schools, it's a heavy lift to make this transition to remote learning new online tools and shifting the curriculum and changing lesson plans. Like it's a lot of work, and I think a lot of educators are perfectly willing to do that, but probably more willing to do that and more able to do that if there's going to be that extra month of instruction that they have in the North, because in the North schools don't get out until mid-June. That might be one explanation, but we don't really have a good other explanation. And it's also important to point out that when we make that distinction between South and Midwest and so on, that we've controlled for everything else that's different about those states. So the internet access and parent education levels and income levels, all those things, when we say that there's a difference by state, we've accounted for all of these other general differences between the states already. Mm-hmm. And what we're saying is after you've controlled for all of those usual measurable differences between states, there's still a difference in how schools responded.
I know your group is more a research and information clearinghouse than a strict advocacy group. And you make the point that you don't necessarily advocate for any particular policies, if I read that correctly. But
right. But
you do at least point to some options that, you know, local, state, and federal educators should keep in mind, at least, you know, on the basis of your findings here. Talk about some of those options,
right,
especially as they apply here in Louisiana.
Well, so, you know, I'm trying to connect the things that policymakers could do to the findings directly. So one finding about internet access being an important factor, well, so there's something you can do about that, right? So we can finally provide universal high-speed internet, which is something that made sense in lots of ways even before this started, and now mm-hmm. seems to make especially good sense. That's one that, you know, especially at the state and federal level, that that's where that would have to happen, or where both the resources and some of the regulatory side of that would have to come from. Some schools kind of handle it on their own by buying hotspots and so on as a Band-Aid solution, and that kudos to them for doing that.
Seen that a bit here locally as well.
Right, exactly. That's one example. When you think about the fact that parent education levels predicted it, mostly that's reflecting the home environment, and so having income security for families then is going to affect children's educational experience as well. So if that's the policy option, then that would help address that concern. We shifted the learning environment from schools to homes, and so that means the home conditions matter more. And so those are just a couple of ideas on ways to move forward with that.
do want to let listeners know that they will be able to find a link to your full reporting on our website at the post page for this podcast. But Doug Harris, thank you so much for taking some time to walk us through this. Really appreciate it.
And well, thanks for having me.
And that's all for this week. We broadcast the podcast Saturday mornings at 9 on 90.3 FM WAMF LP New Orleans and Monday mornings at 10 on 102.3 FM WHIV LP New Orleans. Lens reporting is always online at thelensnola.org. I'm Tom Wright. Keep a mask on your face and New Orleans in your heart. Bon weekend.
I'm Charles Maldonado, editor of The Lens. We're committed to covering the COVID-19 crisis here in South Louisiana, but we can't do this work without your continued support for nonprofit news. Learn about ways you can help us keep the lights on at our website. It's thelensnola.org/donate. The Lens is your newsroom, and we thank you.